And then, his wife, Debbie, is not back, but that suits him fine for now. Gives him time to concentrate, really think it all through. Tony rewinds to the row with Ian Ventham and his fury rises again. Ian was cutting him out of the woodlands just like that. A conversation on the way to his car, outdoors, just in case Tony felt like swinging a punch. He would love to have smacked him there and then, but that was the old Tony. So they'd had a little row, nice and quiet, no one could possibly have noticed, and that's good for Tony. When Ventham turns up dead, no one can say they saw Tony Curran and Ian Ventham having a ding-dong. Keeps it clean. Tony sits on a bar stool, pulls it up to the island in his vast kitchen and slides open a drawer. He needs to get a plan down on paper. Tony is not a believer in luck, he's a believer in hard work. If you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. An old English teacher of Tony's had once told him that, and he'd never forgotten it. The next year he had torched the same teacher's car following an argument about a football, but Tony still had to hand it to the guy. If you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. As it turns out, there is no paper in the drawer, so Tony decides to work out the plan in his head instead. Nothing needs to be done tonight. Let the world continue for a while. Let the birds keep singing in the garden. Let Ventham think he has won. And then strike. Why did people ever mess with Tony Curran? When had that ever worked out for anyone? Tony hears the noise a second too late. He turns to see the spanner as it swings towards him. A big one too, real old school stuff. There's no way of avoiding the swing, and in the brief moment of realization he has, Tony Curran gets it. You can't win them all, Tony. That's fair enough, he thinks, that's fair enough. The blow catches Tony on the left temple and he collapses to the marble floor. The birds in the garden stop singing for the briefest of moments and then continue their merry tune. High up in the sycamore tree. Or is it the beech? The killer places a photograph on the worktop as Tony Curran's fresh blood begins to form a moat around his walnut kitchen island. Chapter 11. Cooper's Chase always wakes early. As the foxes finish their nightly rounds and the birds begin their roll call, the first kettles whistle and the low lamps start to appear in curtained windows. Morning joints creak into life. Nobody here is grabbing toast before an early train to the office or packing a lunchbox before waking the kids, but there is much to do nonetheless. Many years ago, everybody here would wake early because there was a lot to do and only so many hours in the day. Now they wake early because there is a lot to do and only so many days left. Ibrahim is always up by 6. The swimming pool doesn't open until 7 for health and safety reasons. He has argued, unsuccessfully, that the risk of drowning while swimming unsupervised is dwarfed by the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease or respiratory or circulatory illness due to lack of regular exercise. He even produced an algorithm proving that keeping the pool open 24 hours a day would make residents 31.7% safer than closing it overnight. The Leisure and Recreation Amenities Committee remained unmoved. Ibrahim could see that their hands were tied by various directives and so held no grudge. The algorithm was neatly filed away, should it ever be needed again. There was always a lot to do. "I have a job for you, Ibrahim," says Elizabeth, sipping a mint tea. Well, a job for you and Ron, but I'm putting you in charge.
Very wise, says Ibrahim, nodding.
If I might say. Elizabeth had rung him the night before with the news about Tony Curran. She had heard from Ron, who had heard it from Jason, who had heard it from a source yet to be documented. Dead in his kitchen, blunt force trauma to the head, found by his wife. Ibrahim usually likes to spend this hour looking through old case notes and sometimes even new ones. He still has a few clients and, if they are ever in need, they will make the trip out to Cooper's Chase and sit in the battered chair under the painting of the sailing boat, both of which have followed him round for nearly 40 years now. Yesterday, Ibrahim had been reading the notes of an old client of his, a Midland bank manager from Godalming who took in stray dogs and killed himself one Christmas day. No such luck this morning, Ibrahim thinks. Elizabeth had arrived with the sunrise. He is finding the break in his routine challenging. All I need you to do is to lie to a senior police officer, says Elizabeth. Can I trust you with that?
When can you not trust me, Elizabeth? Says Ibrahim.
When have I let you down?
Well, never, Ibrahim, agrees Elizabeth. That's why I like to keep you around. Also, you make very good tea.
Ibrahim knows he is a safe pair of hands. Over the years, he has saved lives and saved souls. He was good at what he did, and that's why, even now, some people will drive for miles past the old phone box and the farm shop, turning right just after the bridge and left by the wooden bus stop, just to speak to an 80-year-old psychiatrist long retired. Sometimes he fails. Who doesn't in this world? And those are the files that Ibrahim will reach for in those early mornings. The bank manager who sat in the battered chair and cried and cried and could not be saved. But this morning, there are different priorities. He understands that. This morning, the Thursday Murder Club has a real-life case. Not just yellowing pages of smudged type from another age. A real case, a real corpse, and somewhere out there, a real killer. This morning, Ibrahim is needed, which is what he lives for.
Chapter 12. PC Donna de Freitas carries a tray of teas into the incident room. A local builder, Tony something, has been murdered, and judging by the size of the assembled team, it's a big deal. Donna wonders why. If she takes her time with the teas, maybe she can find out. DCI Chris Hudson is addressing the team. He always seems nice enough. He once opened some double doors for her without looking like he wanted a medal for it.
There are cameras at the property and plenty of them. Get the footage. Tony Curran left Cooper's Chase at 2 p.m. and he died at 3:32, according to his Fitbit. That's only a small window to search.
Donna has placed the tea tray on a desk while she stoops to tie her shoelace. She hears Cooper's Chase mentioned, which is interesting.
There are also cameras on the A214, around 400 metres south of Curran's house and half a mile north, so let's get hold of that footage too. You know the time frame.
Chris stops for a moment and looks over to where Donna de Freitas is crouching.
Everything all right, Constable? He asks.
Donna straightens up.
Yes, sir, just tying my shoelaces. I wouldn't want a trip with a tray of tea.
Very wise, agrees Chris. Thank you for the tea. We'll let you get on now.
Thank you, sir, says Donna and walks towards the door.
She realises that Chris, a detective, of course, has probably spotted that her shoes have no laces. But surely he wouldn't blame a young constable for a bit of healthy curiosity.
As she opens the door to leave, she hears Chris Hudson continue. Until we get all that, the biggest lead is the photograph the killer left by the body. Let's take a look.
Donna can't resist turning and sees, projected onto the wall, an old photograph. Three men in a pub laughing and drinking. Their table is covered in banknotes. She only has a moment, but she recognises one of the men immediately. Things would be very different when Donna was part of a murder squad, very different. No more visiting primary schools to write serial numbers on bikes in invisible ink. No more politely reminding local shopkeepers that overflowing bins were actually a criminal of...
Constable, says Chris, snapping Donna from her train of thought.
Donna takes her eyes off the photo and looks at Chris. Firmly but kindly, he motions that she is free to leave. Donna smiles at Chris and nods.
Daydreaming. Sorry, sir.
She opens the door, walks through, back to the boredom. She strains to hear every last word before the door finally swings shut. So, three men, all of whom we obviously know very well. Shall we take them one by one? The door clunks shut. Donna sighs.
Chapter 13. Joyce. I hope you will forgive a morning diary entry, but Tony Curran is dead. Tony Curran is the builder who put this place up. Perhaps he even laid the bricks in my fireplace, who knows? I mean, probably not. He probably had someone else to do that for him, didn't he? And all the plastering and what have you. He would have just overseen things, I suppose. But I bet his fingerprints are here somewhere, which is quite a thrill. Elizabeth rang me last night with the news. I would never describe Elizabeth as breathless, but honestly, she wasn't far off. Tony Curran was bludgeoned of all things, by hand or hands unknown. I told her what I'd seen with Ron and Jason, the row between Curran and Ian Ventham. She told me she already knew, so she must have spoken to Ron before she spoke to me, but she was polite enough to listen as I gave my view of it. I asked her if she was taking notes and she said she would remember it. Anyway, Elizabeth seems to have some sort of plan. She said she is seeing Ibrahim this morning. I asked her if there was any way I might be able to help, and she said that there was. So I asked her what that way might be, and she said, if I held my horses, I would find out soon enough. So, I suppose I sit and wait for instructions. I'm going to take the minibus into Fairhaven later, but I shall keep my mobile on just in case. I have become someone who has to keep their mobile on.
Chapter 14. So, who killed Tony Curran and how do we catch him? Asks Elizabeth. Or catch him or her. I know I should say, but it's probably him. What kind of woman would bludgeon someone? A Russian woman, but that's about it. After giving Ibrahim his instructions for the day, Elizabeth had headed straight over for this chat. She is in her usual chair. He absolutely seems the type to have had enemies. Sleeveless vest, big house, more tattoos than Ron, so on and so forth. The police will be making a list of suspects right now, and we'll have to get our hands on it. In the absence of their list, though, why don't we look at whether Ian Ventham killed Tony Curran? You remember Ian Ventham, with the aftershave? Ventham and Tony Curran had a little fight. Ron saw them. Of course, when does he ever miss a thing? And Joyce said something about Pizza Express, but I knew what she meant. Elizabeth tries to mention Joyce more often these days, because why deny it? Shall we make some reasonable assumptions? Let's say that Ventham is unhappy with Curran or Curran is unhappy with Ventham. It doesn't matter much which. They have something to discuss and yet they meet in public, which is peculiar. Elizabeth checks her watch.
She is subtle about it, despite everything.
So, let's say straight after the consultation meeting, Ventham has bad news to break. He fears Curran's reaction so much that he meets him in public view. He hopes to placate him, but in Ron's view, he was unsuccessful. I'm paraphrasing Ron there. There is a small sponge cube on a stick next to the bed. Elizabeth places it in a jug of water and wets Penny's dry lips. The metallic chirp of Penny's heart monitor fills the silence.
So how would Ventham react in that scenario, Penny? Facing Curran with a grudge, switch to plan B, follow Curran to his house, let me in, let's just talk about this, perhaps I've been too hasty, and then wallop. As simple as that, don't you think? He kills Curran before Curran kills him.
Elizabeth looks around for her bag. She places her hands on the arms of the chair, ready to leave.
But why?
That's the question I know you'd ask. I'm going to try and take a look at their financial relationship. Chase the money. There's a man in Geneva who owes me a favour, so we should be able to get Ventham's financial records by this evening. Either way, it sounds like fun, doesn't it? An adventure. And I think we'll have a few tricks that the police won't. I'm sure they'd appreciate a bit of help, and that's my task for this morning.
Elizabeth gets out of her chair and walks to the side of the bed.
A real murder to investigate, Penny. I promise I won't let you miss a thing.
She kisses her best friend on the forehead. She turns to the chair on the other side of the bed and gives a small smile.
How are you, John?
Penny's husband puts down his book and looks up.
Oh, you know.
I do know. You always know where I am, John. The nurses say Penny Gray can hear nothing. But who is to say? John never speaks to Penny while Elizabeth is in the room. He comes into Willows at 7 each morning and he leaves at 9 each evening. Back to the flat that he and Penny had lived in together. Back to the holiday trinkets and the old photos and the memories that he and Penny shared for 50 years. She knows that he talks to Penny when she is not there. And every time she walks in, always after knocking, she notices the fading white prints of John's hand on Penny's. His hand back on his book, though he always seems to be on the same page. Elizabeth leaves the lovers together.
Chapter 15. Joyce. Every Wednesday I take the residence minibus into Fairhaven to do a spot of shopping. On Mondays it goes to Tunbridge Wells, half an hour in the other direction, but I like the younger feel of Fairhaven. I like to see what people are wearing and I like to hear the seagulls. The driver's name is Carlito and he is generally understood to be Spanish, but I have chatted to him a number of times now and it turns out he's Portuguese. He is very good about it, though. There is a vegan cafe just off the seafront that I found a few months ago, and I am already looking forward to a nice mint tea and an almond flour brownie. I am not a vegan and have no intention of ever becoming one, but I still feel like it's something that should be encouraged. I read that if mankind doesn't stop eating meat, there will be mass starvation by 2050. With respect, I am nearly 80, and so this won't be my problem, but I do hope they sort it out. My daughter Joanna is vegetarian, and one day I will take her there. We'll just drop in, as if me visiting a vegan cafe is the most natural thing in the world. The usual crowd are always on the bus. There are regulars, Peter and Carol, a nice couple from Ruskin, who take the minibus down to visit their daughter, who lives on the front. I know there are no grandkids, but nonetheless, she seems to be at home during the day. There will be a story there. There's Sir Nicholas, who just goes for a mooch. Now they won't let him drive anymore.
There's Naomi with her hip that they can't get to the bottom of, and a woman from Wordsworth whose name I have never quite caught and am now too embarrassed to ask. She is friendly enough, though. Elaine? I know that Bernard will be in his customary position at the back. I always feel like I would like to sit next to him. He's jolly company when he turns his mind to it. But I know he visits Fairhaven for his late wife, so I leave him in peace. That's where they met, and that's where they lived before they moved in here. He told me that since she died, he would go to the Adelphi Hotel, where she used to work, and polish off a couple of glasses of wine overlooking the sea. That's how I first found out about the minibus, if I'm honest, so silver linings. They turned the Adelphi into a travel lodge last year, so now Bernard sits on the pier. That is less desolate than it sounds, as they recently revamped it, and it has won a number of awards. Perhaps I will just sit next to him at the back of the bus one day. What am I waiting for? I'm looking forward to my tea and brownie, but I'm also looking forward to a bit of peace and quiet. The whole of Cooper's Chase is still gossiping about poor Tony Curran. We are around death a lot here, but even so, not everyone is bludgeoned, are they? Right, that's me. If anything happens, I will report back. Chapter 16. As the minibus is about to leave, the doors slide open for a final time and Elizabeth steps in. She takes the seat next to Joyce. Good morning, Joyce, she says, smiling. Well, this is a first, says Joyce. How lovely. I've brought a book, if you don't want to talk on the journey, says Elizabeth. Oh, no, let's talk, says Joyce. Carlito pulls away with his customary care. Splendid, says Elizabeth. I haven't really brought a book. Elizabeth and Joyce settle into conversation. They are very careful not to talk about the Tony Curran case. One of the first things you learn at Cooper's Chase is that some people can still actually hear. Instead, Elizabeth tells Joyce about the last time she went to Fairhaven, which was sometime in the 1960s, and whose purpose concerned a piece of equipment that had washed up on the beach. Elizabeth refuses to be drawn into details, but tells Joyce it was almost certainly now a matter of public record, and she could presumably look it up somewhere if she was interested. The journey passes very pleasantly. The sun is up, the skies are blue, and murder is in the air. As always, Carlito stops the minibus outside Ryman's. Everyone knows to meet back here in 3 hours' time. Carlito has done this job for 2 years now, and not a single person has ever been late. Except for Malcolm Weeks, who, as it turned out, had died in the light bulb aisle in Robert Dias. Joyce and Elizabeth let the others out first, allowing their assault course of ramps and sticks and frames to disperse. Bernard doffs his hat to the ladies as he exits, and they watch as he shuffles towards the seafront, his Daily Express tucked under his arm. As they step down from the bus and Elizabeth thanks Carlito for his considerate driving in perfect Portuguese, Joyce thinks to ask for the first time what Elizabeth is planning to do in Fairhaven. Same as you, dear, shall we? Elizabeth starts walking away from the seafront and Joyce chooses to follow, keen for adventure but still hopeful she might have time for her tea and brownie. A short walk away is Western Road and the broad stone steps of Fairhaven Police Station. Elizabeth turns back to Joyce as the automatic doors open in front of her. Here's the way I see it, Joyce. If we are going to investigate this murder...
We're going to investigate the murder? Asks Joyce.
Of course we are, Joyce, says Elizabeth. Who better than us? But we have no access to any files, any witness statements, any forensic, and we are going to have to change that, which is why we're here. I know I don't need to say this, Joyce, but just back me up, whatever happens.
Joyce nods. Of course, of course. They walk in. Once inside, the two ladies are buzzed through a security door into a public reception area. Joyce has never been inside a police station before, though has watched every ITV documentary going, and is disappointed that no one is being wrestled to the ground and dragged to a cell, their obscenities thrillingly bleeped out. Instead, there is just a young desk sergeant, pretending he isn't playing patience on his home office computer.
"How can I help you, ladies?" he asks.
Elizabeth starts to cry. Joyce manages to control her double take.
"Someone just stole my bag outside Holland and Barrett," weeps Elizabeth.
So that's why she didn't have a bag with her, thinks Joyce. That had been bugging her in the minibus. Joyce puts her arm round her friend's shoulders.
"It was awful.
Let me get an officer to take a statement from you and we'll see what we can do." The desk sergeant presses a buzzer on the wall to his left and within seconds a young constable enters through a further security door behind him. "Mark, this lady has just had her handbag stolen on Queen's Road. Can you take a statement? I'll make a cuppa for everyone."
"Certainly. Madam, if you'll follow me."
Elizabeth stands her ground and refuses to move. She is shaking her head, cheeks wet with tears now.
"I want to talk to a female police constable."
"I'm sure Mark can sort this out for you," says the desk sergeant.
"Please," cries Elizabeth.
Joyce decides the time has come to help her friend out.
"My friend is a nun, Sergeant."
"A nun?" says the desk sergeant.
"Yes, a nun," says Joyce, "and I'm sure I don't need to tell you what that entails."
The desk sergeant sees that this is a discussion that could end badly in so many ways and chooses an easy life. "If you'll give me a moment, madam, I will find someone for you." He follows Mark back through the security door and Elizabeth and Joyce are alone for a minute. Elizabeth stops the waterworks and looks over at Joyce.
"A nun! That was very good!"
I didn't have much time to think," says Joyce.
"If pushed, I was going to say someone had touched me," says Elizabeth. "You know how hot they are on that these days, but a nun is much more fun."
"Why do you want to see a female officer?" Joyce has a number of other questions now, but this is first in the queue. "And well done on not saying WPC, by the way. I'm proud of you."
"Thank you, Joyce. I just thought that, as the bus was going into Fairhaven anyway, we should pop in and see PC De Freitas."
Joyce nods slowly. In Elizabeth's world, that is absolutely the sort of thing that makes sense.
"But what if she's not on shift, or what if she is, but there are other female constables?"
"Would I have brought you here if I hadn't already checked that, Joyce?"
"How did you check that?"
The security door opens and Donna De Freitas steps through.
"Now, ladies, how can I..."
Donna registers who is in front of her. She looks from Elizabeth to Joyce and back again.
"Help you."
Chapter 17. DCI Chris Hudson has been given a file on Tony Curran so thick it makes a pleasing thud if you drop it on a desk, which is what he has just done. Chris takes a swig of Diet Coke. He sometimes worries he is addicted to it. He had read a headline about Diet Coke once, which was so worrying he had chosen not to read the article. He opens the file. Most of Tony Curran's dealings with Kent Police were from before Chris's time in Fairhaven. Charges for assault in his 20s, minor drug convictions, dangerous driving, dangerous dog, possession of an illegal weapon, a tax disc misdemeanour, public urination. Then comes the real story. Chris opens an indeterminate sandwich from the garage. There are transcripts of a number of interviews held with Tony Curran over the years, with the last one being after a shooting in the Black Bridge pub, which left a young drug dealer dead. A witness recognised Tony Curran as firing the fatal shot, and Fairhaven CID called Curran in for questioning. Tony Curran had been in the middle of everything back then. Ask around and anyone would tell you Tony ran the drugs trade in Fairhaven and plenty more besides, made a lot of money. Chris reads the depressingly familiar stream of no comments on the Black Bridge transcript. He reads that the witness, a local taxi driver, had disappeared soon after, scared away, or worse. Tony Curran, local builder, walked away scot-free. So what was that? One death? Two? The drug dealer shot at the Black Bridge and perhaps the poor taxi driver who witnessed it? Since 2000, though, nothing. A speeding ticket, promptly paid in 2009. He looks at the photograph the killer had left by the body. Three men. Tony Curran, now dead. With his arm around Tony was a local dealer from back in the day, Bobby Tanner, hired as muscle. Whereabouts currently unknown, but they would track him down soon enough. And the third man, whereabouts very much known. The ex-boxer, Jason Ritchie. Chris wonders what the newspapers would pay for this photo. He has heard of officers doing this, the lowest of the low as far as Chris is concerned. He looks at the smiles, the banknotes and the beers. It was probably sometime around 2000, when the boy was shot in the Black Bridge. Funny to think of the year 2000 as ancient history. Chris opens a Twix as he studies the photo. He has his annual medical in 2 months, and every Monday he convinces himself that this is finally the week he gets back into shape, finally shifts the stone or so that holds him back, the stone or so that gives him cramp, the stone or so that stops him buying new clothes, just in case, and that stops him dating, because who would want this? The stone or so that stands between him and the world. Two stone, if he's really honest. Those Mondays are usually good. Chris doesn't take the lift on Mondays. Chris brings food from home on Mondays. Chris does sit-ups in bed on Mondays. But by Tuesday, or in a good week, Wednesday, the world creeps back in. The stairs seem too daunting and Chris loses faith in the project. He's aware that the project is himself, and that drags him further down still. So out come the pasties and the crisps, the petrol station lunch, the quick drink after work, the takeaway on the way home from work, the chocolate on the way home from the takeaway, the eating, the numbing, the release, the shame, and then repeat. But there was always next Monday. And one of these Mondays, there would be salvation. That stone would drop off, followed by the other stone that was lurking. He'd barely break sweat at the medical. He'd be the athlete he always secretly knew he was. Text a thumbs up to the new girlfriend he'd have met online. He finishes the Twix and looks round for his crisps. Chris Hudson guesses that the Black Bridge shooting was the wake-up call that Tony Curran had needed. That was certainly how it looked. He had started working with a local property developer called Ian Ventham around this time, and perhaps he decided life would be simpler if he turned legit. There was good money in it, even if it was not what he had grown used to. Tony must have known he couldn't keep riding his luck. Chris opens the crisps and looks at his watch. He has an appointment and he should probably head off.
Someone saw Tony Curran having a row just before he died, and that someone is insisting on talking to him personally. It's not a long trip. The retirement community Curran had been working at. Chris looks at the photo again. The three men, that happy gang. Tony Curran and Bobby Tanner, arms around each other and, off to the side, a bottle in his hand, and that handsome broken nose, maybe a couple of years past the height of his powers, Jason Ritchie. Three friends, drinking beer, at a table covered with money. Why leave the photo by the body? A warning from Bobby Tanner or Jason Ritchie? A warning to them? You're next? More likely a red herring or a misdirect. No one would be so stupid. Either way, Chris will need to have a chat with Jason Ritchie and, hopefully, his team will find their missing man, Bobby Tanner. Actually, they're missing men, thinks Chris, tipping the last of the crisps into his mouth. Because who took the photograph in the first place? Chapter 18. Donna motions for her two visitors to sit. They are in Interview Suite B, a boxy, windowless room with a wooden table bolted to the floor. Joyce looks around her with the excitement of a tourist. Elizabeth looks at home. Donna has her eyes on the heavy door, waiting for it to swing shut. The moment it clicks into place, she looks straight at Elizabeth. So you're a nun now, Elizabeth. Elizabeth nods quickly, raising a finger to acknowledge that this is a good question. Donna, like any modern woman, I am any number of things, as and when the need arises. We have to be chameleons, don't we? She takes a notepad and pen from an inside coat pocket and places them on the table. But Joyce takes the credit for that one. Joyce is still staring around the room. This is exactly like you see on television, PC de Freitas. How wonderful! It must be so much fun to work here. Donna is not sharing in the sense of awe. So, Elizabeth, have you had a bag stolen?
No, dear, says Elizabeth.
Good luck to anybody trying to steal my bag, can you imagine? Then can I ask what the two of you are doing here? I have work that needs finishing. Elizabeth nods. Of course, that's very reasonable. Well, I'm here because I wanted to talk to you about something. And Joyce was here for shopping, I presume, Joyce. I realise I haven't asked.
I like to go to Anything with a Pulse, the vegan cafe, if you know it.
Donna looks at her watch, then leans forward. Well, here I am. If you want to talk, go ahead. I'll give you 2 minutes before I go back to catching criminals. Elizabeth gives a light clap of the hands.
Excellent.
Well, first, I will say this. Stop pretending you are not pleased to see us again, because I know that you are. And we're pleased to see you again. This will be so much more fun if we can all just accept that.
Donna does not reply. Joyce leans into the tape recorder sitting on the table.
For the purposes of the tape, PC de Freitas refuses to answer, but is attempting to hide a slight smile.
Secondly, but connected to that, continues Elizabeth, whatever it is we are keeping you from, I know one thing for certain, it isn't catching criminals. It is something boring.
No comment, deadpans Donna.
Where are you from, Donna? May I call you Donna?
You may.
I'm from South London. Transferred from the Met?
Donna nods. Elizabeth makes a note in her book.
You're taking notes? Asks Donna.
Elizabeth nods.
Why so? And Why to Fairhaven?
That's a story for another day. You have one more question before I leave the room, fun though this is.
Of course, replies Elizabeth. She shuts her notebook and adjusts her glasses. Well, I have a statement, really, but I promise it ends with a question.
Donna turns up her palms, inviting Elizabeth to continue.
This is what I see, and I know you'll stop me if I misspeak. You are in your mid-twenties. You give the impression of being clever and intuitive. You also give the impression of being very kind, yet very handy should a fight erupt. For reasons we will get to the bottom of, almost certainly a doomed relationship, you have left London, where I would have thought the life and the work would have suited you to a T. You find yourself here in Fairhaven, where the crime is minor and the criminals are petty. And you are pounding the streets. Maybe a junkie steals a bicycle, Donna. Maybe someone drives off from a petrol station without paying. Or maybe there's a fight over a girl in a pub. Goodness me, what a bore. For reasons that are not of importance, I once worked in a bar in the former Yugoslavia for 3 months, and my brain was screaming out for excitement, for stimulation, for something extraordinary to happen. Does that sound familiar? You are single, you are living in a rented flat, you have not found it easy to make friends in the town. Most of your colleagues in the station are a bit old for you. I'm sure that young PC Mark has asked you out, but there's no way he could handle a South London girl, so you had to say no. You both still find it awkward, that poor boy. Your pride won't allow you to go back to the Met for a good while, and so you're stuck here for the time being. You're still the new girl, so promotion is a pretty distant prospect, added to the fact you're not all that popular because deep down everyone can tell you've made a mistake and you resent being here. You can't even quit. Why throw away these years on the force, the tough years, just because of a wrong turn? So, you strap on the uniform and you turn up shift after shift, teeth gritted, just waiting for something extraordinary to happen. Like, perhaps, a woman who isn't a nun, pretending her bag has been stolen. Elizabeth raises an eyebrow at Donna, looking for a response. Donna is utterly impassive, utterly unimpressed. I'm still waiting for the question, Elizabeth. Elizabeth nods and opens her notebook again. My question is this. Wouldn't you like to be investigating the Tony Curran murder? There is a silence as Donna slowly weaves her hands together and rests her chin on them. She considers Elizabeth very carefully before speaking.
There is already a team investigating the Tony Curran murder, Elizabeth. A highly qualified murder squad. I recently delivered tea to it. They don't really have a vacancy for a PC who tuts every time she gets asked to do the photocopying. Have you ever thought it's possible you don't really understand how the police works? Elizabeth notes this down and talks as she writes. That is possible. How complicated it all must be. But a lot of fun, I imagine.
I imagine too, agrees Donna.
They say he was bludgeoned, says Elizabeth, with a large spanner. Could you confirm that?
No comment, Elizabeth, says Donna.
Elizabeth stops writing and looks up again. Wouldn't you like to be part of it, Donna?
Donna starts to drum her fingers on the desk. Okay, let's just suppose I would like to be involved in the murder investigation.
Yes, quite. Let's suppose that. Let's start there and see where we get to.
You do understand how CID works, Elizabeth. I can't
simply asked to be assigned to a particular investigation. Elizabeth smiles.
Oh, goodness, don't you worry about that, Donna. We can take care of it all.
You can take care of it?
Well, I should have thought so, yes.
How? Asks Donna.
Well, there's always a way, isn't there?
But you would be interested if we could make it happen? Donna looks back at the heavy door safely shut. When could you make that happen, Elizabeth? Elizabeth looks at her watch and gives a small shrug.
An hour, perhaps?
And this conversation never leaves this room? Elizabeth puts a finger to her lips. Then I would. Yes, please. Donna holds up her hands, open and honest. I would really, really like to chase murderers. Elizabeth smiles and puts her notebook back in her pocket. Well, this is smashing. I thought I had read the situation correctly.
What's in it for you? Asked Donna.
Nothing other than a favour to a new friend. And we might have the odd question here or there about the investigation, just to satisfy our curiosity.
You know, I couldn't tell you anything confidential. That's not a deal I can agree to.
Nothing unprofessional, I promise you, Elizabeth crosses herself, as a woman of God.
And in an hour, you say?
Elizabeth looks at her watch.
I'd say about an hour, depending on the traffic.
Donna nods, as if this makes complete sense.
About your little speech, though, Elizabeth, I don't know if it was just designed to impress me or to show off in front of Joyce, but it was pretty obvious stuff.
Elizabeth concedes the point. Obvious, but right, dear.
Almost right. But you're not quite Miss Marple, is she, Joyce?
Joyce pipes up.
Oh, yes, that boy Mark is gay, Elizabeth. You'd have to be fairly blind to miss that.
Donna smiles. Lucky you have your friend with you, sister. She likes that Elizabeth is attempting to hide a smile of her own.
I'll need your mobile number, by the way, Donna, says Elizabeth. I don't really want to fake a crime every time I need to see you.
Donna slides a card over the table.
I hope that's a personal number and not an official one, says Elizabeth. It would be nice to have some privacy.
Donna looks at Elizabeth, shakes her head and sighs. She writes down another number on the card.
Lovely, says Elizabeth. I suspect between us we can find whoever killed Tony Curran. It can't be beyond the wit of man, or rather, woman.
Donna stands.
Should I ask how you can get me on the investigating team, Elizabeth, or don't I want to know?
Elizabeth checks her watch. Nothing you need to concern yourself with. Ron and Ibrahim should be taking care of it about now.
Joyce waits for Elizabeth to stand too, then leans into the tape recorder once again.
Interview terminated, 12:47 p.m.
Chapter 19. DCI Chris Hudson swings his Ford Focus onto the long, broad driveway leading up to Cooper's Chase. The traffic hasn't been at all bad, and he is hoping this won't take too long. As he checks out his surroundings, Chris wonders why this place needs quite so many llamas. There are no spaces in the visitor's car park, so he eases the Focus onto a verge and steps out into the Kent sun. Chris has been to retirement communities before, and this is not at all what he had been expecting. This is a whole village. He wanders past a bowls match, wine chilling in coolers at each end. One of the players is an extremely elderly woman smoking a pipe. He follows a meandering path through a perfect English garden flanked by three stories of flats.
There are people gossiping on patios and balconies enjoying the sunshine. Friends sit on benches, bees buzz round bushes, light breezes play tunes with ice cubes. Chris finds the whole thing deeply infuriating. He's a wind and rain guy, a turn up the collar on your overcoat man. If Chris had his way, he would hibernate for the summer. He has not worn shorts since 1987. Chris crosses a residence car park past a red post box, looking picture book perfect, annoying him further, and finds Wordsworth Court. He rings the buzzer for flat 11, Mr. Ibrahim Arif. After being buzzed up and walking across a lushly carpeted hallway and up a lushly carpeted staircase and knocking on a solid oak door, Chris finds himself in the flat of Ibrahim Arif, sitting opposite the man himself and also opposite Ron Ritchie. Ron Ritchie. Well, wasn't that quite the thing? Chris had been taken aback the moment they had been introduced. The father of a man Chris was investigating. What was that? Luck? Something more sinister. Chris decides he will just let it play out. He trusts that if there is an angle, he will spot it. Strange that this is where Red Ron ended up, though. The scourge of the bosses, the beast of British Leyland and British Steel and British whatever else you'd care to mention, amidst the honeysuckle and Audis of Cooper's Chase. Chris would have barely recognised him, to be honest. Ron Ritchie is wearing mismatched pyjamas, an unzipped tracksuit top and dress shoes. He is looking around vacantly, mouth open. He is a mess, and Chris feels awkward, as if he is imposing on a private scene. Ibrahim is explaining the situation to DCI Chris Hudson. It can be very stressful for elderly people to talk to police officers. You mustn't think that's your fault. This is why I suggested you conduct the interview here. Chris nods gently because he has done the training. I can assure you that Mr. Ritchie is not in trouble, but if, as you say, he has information, I will need to ask him a couple of questions. Ibrahim turns to Ron. Ron, he just wants to ask you about the argument you saw. Remember we talked about it? Ibrahim looks back to Chris. He forgets things. He's very old, Detective Chief Inspector, a very, very old man. All right, Ibrahim, says Ron. Ibrahim pats Ron's hand and speaks to him slowly. I think it's quite safe, Ron. We've seen this gentleman's warrant card. I rang the number on it, then I Googled him. Remember? I just don't think I can, says Ron. I don't want to get into any trouble. There won't be any trouble, Mr. Ritchie, says Chris. I guarantee it. It's just that you might have important information. Red Ron is a shadow of his former self, and Chris is very aware that he must play this carefully. Certainly don't mention Jason yet. The possibility of a pub lunch is also rapidly vanishing. Mr. Arif is right. You can tell me anything. Ron looks at Chris, then back to Ibrahim for signs of reassurance. Ibrahim squeezes his friend's arm and Ron looks at Chris again, then leans forward. I think I'd be happier talking to the lady. Chris is taking his first sip of the mint tea Ibrahim has made for him. The lady? He looks at Ron and then at Ibrahim. Ibrahim helps him out. Which lady, Ron? The lady, Ib. The one who comes and talks to us, the woman copper. Oh, yes, says Ibrahim. P.C. de Freitas.
She often comes to talk to us, Detective Chief Inspector. Window looks. Do you know her?
Of course. Yes, she is one of my team.
Chris is trying to remember if the young PC with the non-existent shoelaces was Donna De Freitas. He was fairly sure she was. She'd come from the Met and no one knew why. We work very closely together. So, she is part of the investigation. This is excellent news, Ibrahim beams. We love PC De Freitas here.
Well, she's not officially part of the investigation team, Mr. Arif, says Chris. She's on other important duties, catching criminals and so on.
Ron and Ibrahim don't say a word. They just look expectantly at Chris.
But it is a terrific idea. I would love her to be on the team, says Chris, trying to work out who he would need to speak to. Surely someone owed him a favour.
She is a fine officer, says Ibrahim. She does you credit. Ibrahim becomes serious again and turns to Ron.
So, if the handsome detective here and our friend PC De Freitas came to talk to you together, would you be happy, Ron?
Ron takes his first sip of tea.
That'd be perfect, Ib. I'd like that. I'll talk to Jason, too.
Jason? Asks Chris, on alert.
Do you like boxing, son? Asks Ron.
Chris nods. Very much, Mr. Ritchie.
My boy is a boxer. Jason.
I know, sir, says Chris. You must be very proud.
Only he was with me, so he should be here. He saw the row too.
Chris nods. Well, that was very interesting. The trip has not been wasted.
Well, I'm sure I can come back and talk to you both. And you'll bring PC De Freitas with you?
How wonderful, says Ibrahim.
Yes, of course, says Chris.
Whatever gets us to the truth.
Chapter 20, Joyce.
So, it seems we are investigating a murder. And better still, I have been in a police interview room. This diary is bringing me luck. It was interesting watching Elizabeth in action. She is very impressive, very calm. I wonder if we would have got along if we'd met 30 years ago. Probably not. We are from different worlds, but this place brings people together. I do hope I'll be of some help to Elizabeth in the investigation, help to catch Tony Curran's killer. Perhaps I will, in my own way. I think that if I have a special skill, it is that I am often overlooked. Is that the word? Underestimated, perhaps? Cooper's Chase is full of the great and the good, people who have done something or other with their lives. It's really a lot of fun. There's someone who helped design the Channel Tunnel, someone who has a disease named after them, and someone who was the ambassador to Paraguay or Uruguay. You know the type. And me? Joyce Meadowcroft? What do they make of me, I wonder? Harmless, certainly. Chatty? Guilty, I'm afraid. But I think they know deep down that I'm not one of them. A nurse, not a doctor, not that anyone would say that to my face. They know that Joanna bought my flat here. Joanna is one of them. Me, not so much. And yet, if there's a row at catering committee, or if there's a problem with the lake pumps, or if, as happened very recently, one resident's dog impregnates another and all hell breaks loose, then who is there to fix it? Joyce Meadowcroft.
I am very happy to listen to the grandstanding, watch the chests puffing out, hear the furious threats of legal action and wait for them to blow themselves out. Then I step in and suggest that maybe there's a way through. And perhaps there is a compromise to be reached, and perhaps dogs will be dogs. Nobody here feels threatened by me. Nobody sees me as a rival. I'm just Joyce. Gentle, chatty Joyce. Always has her nose in everything. So, everyone calms down through me. Quiet, sensible Joyce. There is no more shouting and the problem is fixed, more often than not in a way that advantages me. Which is something no one ever seems to notice. So, I am very happy to be overlooked and always have been, and I do think perhaps that will be helpful in this investigation. Everyone can look at Elizabeth, and I'll just get on with being me. The Meadowcroft, by the way, is from my late husband, Jerry, and I have always liked it. I had many reasons to marry Jerry, and his surname was another to add to a long list. A friend of mine from nursing married a Bumstead. Barbara Bumstead. I think I might have found an excuse and called it off. What a day. I think I'll watch an old Prime Suspect and then bed. Whatever Elizabeth needs me to do next, I'll be ready. Chapter 21. It is another beautiful morning. Bogdan Yankovsky is sitting on a swing chair on Ian Ventham's patio and is taking some time to think things through. Tony Curran has been murdered. Someone broke into his home and killed him. There are plenty of suspects and Bogdan is going over a few of them in his head, thinking about reasons they might have for wanting Tony Curran dead. Everyone seems shocked by Tony's death, but nothing surprises Bogdan. People died all the time of all sorts of things. His father had fallen from a dam near Krakow when Bogdan was a child, or jumped, or was pushed, it didn't matter. It didn't change the fact that he had died. Something will always get you in the end. Ian's garden is not to Bogdan's taste. The lawn, which stretches down to a line of trees in the far distance, is orderly and English and striped. Down towards the trees, off to the left, there is a pond. Ian Ventham calls it a lake, but Bogdan knows lakes. It has a small wooden bridge crossing its far end as it narrows. Children would love it, but Bogdan has never seen children in this garden. Ian had bought a family of ducks, but foxes killed the ducks, and then a guy Bogdan knew from the pub had killed the foxes. Ian didn't buy any more ducks after that, because what would be the point? There will always be foxes. Sometimes wild ducks still visited. Good luck to them, was Bogdan's view. The swimming pool is directly on Bogdan's right. You could take a few steps down from the patio and dive straight in. Bogdan had tiled the swimming pool. Bogdan had painted the little bridge duck egg blue, and Bogdan had laid the patio he was sitting on. Ian had come good on his offer and had asked him to oversee the building of the Woodlands development. So he was taking over from Tony, which some people might now see as bad luck, a jinx, perhaps. But to Bogdan, it was just something that was happening, and he would do it as well as he was able. Good money. The money doesn't really interest Bogdan, but the challenge does, and he likes being around the village. He likes the people. Bogdan had seen all the plans now, studied everything. They were complicated at first, but once you'd seen the patterns, simple enough. Bogdan had enjoyed working on smaller jobs for Ian Ventham. He had liked the order of it, but he understands that things change and that he needs to step up.
Bogdan's mother had died when he was 19. She had come into some money when Bogdan's father had died. From somewhere. It hadn't been a time for details. The money paid for Bogdan to take up a place at the Technical University in Krakow to study engineering. And that's where he had been when his mother suffered a stroke and collapsed at home. If he had still been at home, then he would have saved her, but he wasn't. And so he didn't. Bogdan came home, buried his mother, and left for England the next day. Nearly 20 years later, he is looking at a stupid lawn. Bogdan is thinking that he will maybe close his eyes for a moment when, from the other side of the house, comes the deep sound of the front door chimes. A rare visitor to this big, quiet house, and the reason Ian has asked Bogdan to be here today. Ian slides back the patio door of his study. Bogdan. Door.
Yes, of course.
Bogdan gets to his feet. He goes in via the conservatory he designed, through the music room he'd soundproofed, and into the hallway he had once sanded in his underpants on the hottest day of the year. Whatever you needed him to do. Father Matthew Mackey is regretting asking his cabbie to drop him at the bottom of the drive. It had been quite the walk from the front gates to the front door. He fans himself a little with his file, then, quickly using the camera on his phone to check his dog collar is straight, rings the bell. He is relieved to hear noises from within the house, because you never know, even when you've made arrangements. He was happy to meet here. It makes things easier all round. He hears footsteps on a wooden floor and the door is opened by a broad, shaven-headed man. He wears a tight white T-shirt and he has a cross tattooed on one forearm and three names on the other.
Father, says the man.
Good news, a Catholic and, judging by the accent, Polish.
Dzień dobry, says Father Mackey.
The man smiles back.
Dzień dobry, dzień dobry.
I have an appointment to see Mr. Ventham, Matthew Mackey. The man takes his hand and shakes it.
Bogdan Jankowski. Come in, please, Father.
We understand, believe me, that you have no legal imperative to help us, says Father Matthew Mackey. We disagree with the council's ruling, of course, but we must accept it. Mike Griffin from the planning committee had done his job well, thinks Ian. Feel free to dig up the graveyard, Ian, he'd said. Be our guest. Mike Griffin is addicted to online casinos, and long may that continue.
However, I do think you have a moral obligation to leave the Garden of Eternal Rest, the graveyard, exactly where it is, continues Father Mackey, and I wanted to meet you face to face, man to man, and see if we can come to a compromise.
Ian Ventham listens closely, but in honesty is really thinking about how clever he is. He is the cleverest person he knows, that's for certain. That's how he gets what he wants. It feels almost unfair sometimes. He's not even one step ahead of you. He's on an entirely different path. Karen Playfair had been an easy one. If he can't persuade Gordon Playfair to sell his land, then he knows she will. Dads and daughters. And she'd see a chunk of the money, surely. An old man can only turn down a seven-figure sum for a big hill for so long. Ian would always find a way. But Father Mackey is trickier than Karen Playfair. He sees that. Priests weren't like divorcees in their early 50s who could stand to lose a few pounds, were they? You had to pretend to have some respect, and maybe you actually should have some respect. After all, what if they were right? Open mind, which was another example of cleverness being useful. That's why Ian has asked Bogdan to join them. He knows this lot like to stick together, and quite right, who doesn't?
He realizes he should probably speak.
"We're only moving the bodies, Father," says Ian. "It will be done with the greatest of care and the greatest of respect."
Ian knows that this is not strictly true. Legally, he had had to put the job out for public tender. 3 bids had come in. One was from the University of Kent Forensic Anthropology Department, who would certainly do the job with the greatest care and respect. One was from the firm of cemetery specialists in Rye, who had recently moved 30 graves from the site of a new Pets at Home and included pictures of solemn men and women in dark blue overalls digging out graves by hand. The last was from a company set up 2 months ago by Ian himself. With a funeral director from Brighton, he had met playing golf, and Sue Bambury from Ian's village, who rented out diggers. That final pitch was extremely competitive and had won the business. Ian had looked into the excavation of cemeteries online, and it wasn't rocket science. "Some of these graves are nearly 150 years old, Mr. Ventham," says Father Mackey.
"Call me Ian," says Ian.
Ian hadn't strictly needed to have this meeting, but he feels it's better to be safe than sorry. A lot of the residents can get quite churchy when it suits them, and he wouldn't want Father Mackey stirring up trouble. People get funny about corpses. So hear the man out, reassure him, send him happily on his way. Donate to something? There's a thought to keep in the back pocket. "The company you've employed to relocate the cemetery," Mackey looks at his files, "Angels in Transit, the cremoval specialists. They know what they're going to find, I hope. There won't be many intact coffins, Ian, just bones. And not skeletons, loose bones, broken down, scattered, half-rotted, sunk through the earth. And every single fragment of every bone in every single grave needs to be found, needs to be documented, and needs to be respected. That's basic decency. But don't forget that it is also the law." Ian nods, though he is actually wondering if it is possible to paint a digger black. Sue will know. "I am here today," continues Father Mackey, "to ask you to think again. To leave these ladies where they are. To leave them in peace, man to man. I don't know what it would cost you to do that. That's your business. But you have to understand, as a man of God, that it's my business too. I don't want these women moved."
"Matthew, I appreciate you coming to see us," says Ian. "And I see what you're saying about angels, souls in torment, etc., if I'm reading you right. But you said it yourself. All we're fine now is bones. That's all there is. And you can choose to be superstitious or religious in your case. I see that. But I can choose not to be. Now, we'll take care of the bones, and I'm happy for you to be there and watch the lot if that's what floats your boat. But I want to move the cemetery. I'm allowed to move the cemetery, and I'm going to move the cemetery. If that makes me whatever I am, then so be it. Bones don't mind where they are. If I can't change your mind, then I will make this as difficult as I possibly can for you. I need you to know that," says Father Mackey.
"Join the queue, Father," says Ian. "I've got the RSPCA up in arms about badgers. I've got the Kent Forestry something banging on about protected trees. With you, it's nuns. I've got to comply."